episode 5 of Underground Espionage. How's it going, Tara?
It's great. I feel like I'm about to sneeze.
Well, it could happen. It could be the devil.
Devil has possessed me. It's making me sneeze. He's giving me rashes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, we are in the world of the devil right now as we, in fact, just watched Hexen. And I know I pronounced it Haxen when we said what we were going to do this week, but the correct pronunciation is Hexen. I will continue with that. And we just finished watching it and decided let's go ahead and record while it's all in our head. And what inspired the watch of Hexen was Tara's been going through the Gift Nolan book, Christian Olsen's book that came out a bit ago. And he's got a great section about Hexen, as it is a Swedish movie and as it is a very influential movie on him.
Mm-hmm.
So we were going through the article and decided let's watch the movie itself. So we'll be referencing Christian's article, referencing some of the liner notes from the Criterion Blu-ray, and giving our thoughts on this incredible movie.
Yeah, I just decided to readjust my mic stand and make a big ruckus while you were
it's
doing
okay.
That's another decision that was made.
The devil might have made this decision.
I might have been possessed by it. Yeah, I mean, we're going to be saying the devil made me do it for a little bit after watching that. But it really is impactful and being so fresh in our minds right now. My head is swirling, so I don't have any other little...
No, I think we should just get right into it. I don't think
mundane
I think this,
things to discuss.
Yeah, I think this movie requires just us diving right into it because it really, really is incredible. 1922, silent movie made by Benjamin Christensen.
This film, at first watch, I mean, looking at the cover of the Criterion edition, it teases the absurdity and the beauty and the work that went into it. But looking at this, you don't think this was made in 1922.
Oh, no. It's as Christian even says in his article, it's hard to believe that it's been 100 years since this came out.
That's insane.
Absolutely. It feels fresh. And the look of it on its own, if you just took this movie purely mm-hmm. by the look of it, it's an unbelievable movie. It just looks incredible. Every scene is incredible.
From the indoor scenes, from the sets that they designed, representing like the pillars of the sky, down to the demons that are represented, anything stop motion, even just the richness and colors, the vibrancy of the black and white. It's very striking.
Yeah, and then the tinted, either almost like that sepia, but then also there's
the
blue. Yeah.
Yeah, the restoration is unbelievable, but truly the things that were initially captured, it's that thing that kind of like hurts when you're looking at it and you can't wait to look at it again. Like you want to watch it again.
Yeah.
Like this was definitely our base coat to see it again so that we can further appreciate all the work that went into it. Because even now, as we just finished it, I'm still kind of stunned by the torture scenes, the actresses, the story that unfolded, and I didn't get to fully appreciate the early stop motion or the set design.
There's so much to look at and to talk about with this movie that, yeah, you almost forget everything that just happened because there's so much.
I'm already full of regret because I'm like, I'm not going to do this justice.
But I think you will because, and you know, one thing that, you know, Christian talks about in the book and something that we've been talking about a lot in the past few years, especially, is just this idea of Satan as a sinister force,
mm-hmm.
not watering it down with some modern temple of Satan,
not standardizing
it, you know, like we said, like literally after school programs for kids,
mm-hmm.
you know, like you said, I think last on the episode, you know, little pentagram socks, like all this sort of making it
cute pentagram skirts and baby onesies,
bringing it back
and like
to
your Satan water bottle,
to the sinister underground of Satan, and especially how it was viewed in medieval times as it's depicted here, but also in the 20s, how something mm-hmm. satanic would be viewed. And even through, you know, into the 60s, even into Satanic Panic being, you know, there really was murders committed in this way.
Yeah.
You know, obviously they may come from a drugged out teenager like Ricky Casso, but it still has a sinister, actually dark quality.
But
and this is what we are interested in when we talk about Satan.
Yeah, and like, wouldn't that be who it appeals to? It's crazy because we're sitting here talking about Satan, and the wind that has not been existent all day is like fluttering through
it's
our kitchen
through
and making a crazy sound.
The window, it's gray skies out here. So I think it's the perfect time to talk about this movie. Well, Tara, what will you give a bit of an overview of the structure of this movie,
haven't discussed it yet. Hexen means the witch. It's presented in 7 parts, and each part explores a different aspect of the concept of a witch, the ancient life of a witch, the persecution of the witch, and even down to the impact or the presence of the witch in modern society that is unperceived by us because we choose not to call it that, right?
Yeah.
So we kind of take that trajectory. And I love that we do 7 parts, right? Because it's the sacred number 7, right? It's the, I really took interest in the number 7 when I read about Sir Isaac Newton and his work with spectrography. Sorry, I'm like mid sneeze, so I'm going to choke a lot. So, when he was working to look at prisms and the way light is refracted, he starts to identify the colors of the rainbow and how that appears. And when we say that there are 7 colors of the rainbow, the Roy G. Biv, that was outlined by Sir Isaac Newton, but he held to this mystic practice still based in Christianity that 7 was a sacred number. So if you want to know what the difference between blue and indigo is, you can make a lot of theories, but truly he inserted another color so that the number of colors in the rainbow would be 7, and he determined that was, you know, the God number. People say it's the complete number. God rested on the 7th day. But then you look cross-culturally in terms of like the impact of the number 7. The Quran has 7 heavens. Hindus have 7 higher worlds and 7 underworlds. And when the baby Buddha was born, he rose and took 7 steps. Like, 7 is a number that has been present in so many cultures across thousands and thousands of years. Even ancient Egypt had religious practices based on the number of 7. The number 8, we'll talk about that later, was also the number of their heavens because it was a more balanced number. But 7 is the highest of the singular prime numbers under 10, and it is sacred across time. So
the
using 7 parts.
The 7 pillars of wisdom.
Exactly. 7 pillars of wisdom, 7 wonders of the world. You know, we could go on and on. Terms of the impact of 7. So, of course, if we're going to explore the history of mysticism, if we're going to explain the presence of witches and the life that witches have led, and let's call it, you know, our society, because I feel like the medieval times and kind of really kicked off where we landed today, right? Like, there's so many arguments to be made about, you know, what event changed the face of the world and led to modern borders and things, whatever. But in terms of the people that still kind of had our languages present and that we have looked back on, medieval times would be like the most relatable, right? So now we're going to go see these people through our modern eyes and empathize with them through everything they've gone through, and then look at how that perception has evolved over time. So in the first section of the seven parts, we get looks at beautiful Persian deities and lovely Egyptian gods. And he talks about the story of the skies, where the seven pillars are holding up the ceiling of the stars that are hung by ropes, and the world existing as a valley between mountains, and then goes into other creation stories or theories about how the world existed, going into the concentric circles of the medieval belief of the earth, the layer of air, the layer of fire, and then the cosmos that all spun around it.
This opening section is incredible too, because you get these great set pieces already when it's discussing the way the Egyptians saw the structure of earth and how the lights were hanging from strings, and
it literally looks so incredible. And it's really beautiful because it's in a room and you can tell that there are, you know, fabricated mountains and fabricated valleys, but they look stunning. And the way the stars are hung in that, like, beautiful yet orderly, and this is where they did the blue tint on the restoration, and it's absolutely gorgeous. Like, really. And then going into the medieval mindset of how the earth works and how the cosmos work and how the universe works, and using a moving ring of concentric circles that I don't know if it's even stop motion. It's like literally moving.
There is some stop motion in it. Again, it's hard to tell exactly how all of this was done, but that one in particular did look mechanical. Yeah.
And it's really beautiful, and it reminds you of looking at when you're seeing ancient pictures of things that they would call like ancient machines, right? Like in the ancient robots of the Egyptian time that ran on steam and dripping water, or even like those I just blanked on what they're called. Like the things that you would read the sky and ships with, like, you know, they kind of like the inner workings of clockwork. Again, this is like an ancient thought, but it also is recreated with an ancient device. And it is so beautiful. And I love then surrounded by the 12 signs of the zodiac, which again looked just absolutely stunning.
And then surrounded by the heavens, right?
Mm-hmm.
The...
And we don't have to discuss 12. Maybe we can discuss 12 later. 12, the sacred number of ancient Babylonians, which is where we get 12 hours divided by the day, which makes 24 hours a day, 12 months, and the base 60, which was how their math was made. So the Babylonians' obsession with 12 touches us in the zodiac, in 60 minutes and an hour, in 12 months of the year, all of these things.
And in the depiction too, it's the god figure with the nine choirs of angels, right?
Yes,
around
yes.
It looks so, so incredible.
And then, so you have that kind of mechanical contraption, and then he cuts to I'm not going to say ancient, historical relief depiction, like a mechanical depiction of hell, which is
so great.
What would you call those things? Like
I don't know.
Like the clockworks that you see from, you know, medieval times when like somebody comes out and like a lady kisses a man.
Exactly.
And then like a Syrian, and then somebody hammers on something, and then a tree sprouts a leaf, and then a bird
and
whistles. It's one of those.
Yeah, it's this looks just so... I don't even know have the right words for it, right? You're just immediately taken into this, and this is the world you want to be in for the next 2 hours.
Well, I think the whole time watching this, it just churns up all these memories within you. Like, when you see that, you're like, oh, I forgot Astrolab. That's what I couldn't remember. It looked like an Astrolab. Now I can finish my thought. It looks like those things where you're like, I forgot about those. You know what I mean? Like things that you learned about in school, or things that you may have encountered in a church when you were exploring, or things that you may have been visiting a city in Europe and you see these and you're like, oh my God, that's insane. Or that you see in a museum, but you don't encounter it in daily life. And you forget the vivid depictions that people made of hell, and how hell was a real thing that they were thinking about on a more consistent basis, perhaps, than we think about, maybe not, just depending on the person. But and everyone really trying to like flesh out the way that they conceived hell and torture through fires, through skinning and flaying, and like what types cauldrons of pain people feel. Yeah, exactly. Boiling people alive.
Yeah, and this depicts all of that in this mechanical relief type contraption, and it looks so great.
So even down to like the Bosch panels, right? It's so iconic, and I think like as a teenager, everybody discovers them for the first time, and they're like, oh my God, it's so far. Like, it seems to be like the most intense thing to where you can like relate to the past, and you're like, and you look back and you're like, wow, like people were a little more, let's say, far out than I thought they were, or maybe a little darker than I thought they were. And so that is also the like charm of the things that we love to see in artwork, right? You're not looking for like the king sitting on his throne with somebody dancing weird, like, which happens. No, but you want to see like the skeleton and the lady standing together, or the leper covered in boils, or the boiling cauldron with all the demons surrounding it and the fires. I mean, that's kind of like the exciting thing. That's, you know, loving the darkness, loving underground, loving metal, looking at the danger, staring into the pits of hell. And that's kind of where this takes you.
It really, really does. I was going to read from the beginning of the article on Hexen in Giftnollen. Hexen belongs to the more macabre and unusual entries in the history of cinema. It is hard to believe that it was 100 years since its initial release. This quote-unquote cultural historical film in seven acts, unquote, serves as a monument proclaiming the glory of the devil. And I love that. I love the idea of the proclamation of the glory of the devil seen here on one of the earliest films.
Yes, exactly. And so we enter this first part where they tell the history. And then when we get on the second part, we get to see kind of a little compilation. Like, I didn't write down like what each part takes you to, but by this part we're exploring like witches in the world, right?
This is so great.
So from casting a spell on a man's shoe to a witch bewitching a cow, you know, somebody requesting a love spell to get a pious man to make love to her. And that's the joy of the second section. Takes you from like ancient thoughts, beliefs, where we all started, establishes these areas of the ancient gods, but then takes you to a different time when there is the what becomes the modern church, but at the time was also acting more as like a, I don't want to say a police force, but they certainly had a lot of pull in terms of public opinion on what somebody is, how they should behave, what they should do. And they're trying to knock down the ancient gods systematically. So then all the ancient beliefs become heresy. The ancient gods become the devils. So now we're talking about things that people had already been thinking of for thousands of years, interacting with, worshiping, doing whatever practice they have. But now all of those are seen as heresy. And the new people are being ostracized. They're being alienated. They're being criminalized for practicing anything other than the dogma of the church. We'll just call it the church.
I think that's the easiest way to say it. But this section is so great because this, the beginning, it does mix still images of drawings and paintings,
textbooks and rubbings,
and then now we're in the second section, and there now we actually have the live action of these scenes, and
the
and you go into the witch's lair, and it's just immediately a feast for the eyes of darkness. Witches, skulls, skeletons, snakes, a thief's hand that was
wrapped in a bundle of sticks and brought back to the witches so that they
can use the flesh
to make their spells.
And again, this section is taking the idea and the actions of the witch as it's really happening,
mm-hmm.
and I do love that.
Like they are literally, some people are coming to them and they are literally casting spells and making potions, and they have this established procedure and ancient knowledge they're passing on to each other.
This is from the liner notes of the Blu-ray by Chris Fujiwara, and he says, "One of Hexen's masterstrokes is the way it places together on the same level of cinematic depiction, fact and fiction, objective reality and hallucination. It does this with great verve and audacity and with a painstaking eye for detail. Near the start of the film, Christensen establishes a modern, rationalistic point of view. The belief in evil spirits, sorcery, and witchcraft is the result of naive notions about the mystery of the universe that he will then proceed to undermine for much of the rest of the film." So I do love that giving us this and then undermining it immediately and blending fact, fiction, what we're seeing, what he's telling us. Because throughout is, you know, the narration, or obviously the silent narration, the stills of the words.
Yes, this is a silent. This is a silent film. I guess we didn't really.
I think we probably
say
said that.
I don't know if we did say it, but the soundtrack is based on the original score that is played. But
correct.
I would say that it's less important than your words and your vision. And
I really do enjoy the soundtrack. It really swept me away. Of course, this movie would be a movie that many people have done live performances to, including Christian himself.
Exactly.
He says he did it in 2001. But I did enjoy the orchestral music to this, and it really did sweep me away. And I was caught up. You're caught up in this world right away. And it's like I said, especially with this scene in the witch's lair.
Well, and the scene with the witch's lair, like, I mean, it's like, it's so perfect. Like the moods, the areas that are created. I mean, like, you think Lord of the Rings was good, you should watch Hexen, because it's amazing to see the entire realm that they made for them to inhabit. And it feels really authentic. And you can tell that he did work, especially on their attire and on the different methodologies that they were utilizing.
It truly feels like it's being filmed in the 1400s.
Yeah, he did his research. But I think overall, when you go from talking about ancient tradition, the knocking down of old gods and paving way for new god, and really the hold that the church is having over behavior. And then you see the second part where they're making potions that work, and they're actually going through with using a dead man's finger. Because, like, how many of those books were made that were supposed to be real grimoires or magic spell books that were just done salaciously so people could read it and be shocked by, like, grinding up different types of animals and things of that nature. But then you see this, and they're making something effective, and you kind of start going into that thought process. Like, we've all seen films and read about persecution of witches and heretics and all of those things that have been done, the torture, the Spanish Inquisition, and how unfair it might be, or how the feeling around a witch trial. But then I do love when this, because it packs in all of your thoughts around it. Like, what if they're real? What if they were practicing witchcraft? What if they really could do it? What if they didn't do it? Who gives these people the right to do this? Is this something that's still in our society? Or is this something that's inherent within us to want this? Who is actually in control of this? And can this magic be controlled? And can the people who want to suppress it be controlled? Like, you go through all of those things in the journey of this film, and it's so great.
Absolutely. And to go back to what you said about he really did his research, I'm going to read some more from the Gift Nolan article. The acclaimed film director Benjamin Christensen, 1879 to 1959, was in a sense one of the mightiest black magicians at his time, as he not only conjured the dark forces and infernal legions to manifest into this world, but he also skillfully mastered the Laterna Magica. Hexen was to become his life's work, and came as a result of his massive research into the fields of black magic and demonology. Having the ambition to approach the different topics with the seriousness they deserved, rather than going for cheap tricks to scare people with the damnation and hellfire. The shootings took place under total secrecy for a couple of years, with the initial screenings in 1922. It is a cinematic landmark, with striking reenactments of sceneries both from out of history and from the abysmal depths of his own phantasmagoric imagination. The narration was based upon Benjamin Christensen's scholarly dissertation on the subject. He had envisioned a lecture in moving pictures that would merge anthropological and psychological perspectives with his own visual conceptions of the subjects, creating a display of witchcraft as a living tradition. From the excessive reenactments of satanic initiation rituals and the ecstatic, orgiastic black masses at Blackula, to modern times when the tormentors of the Inquisition have shifted their black hoods for white coats. And that really hits exactly the what this movie does.
Mm-hmm. Yes, like the cat feces and boiled dove hearts to cast a little weak love spell, and then just one drop into a man's drink will make him love you. And then what if you have a vial that was a vital, strong male bird who was boiled in the heart of springtime? That's really going to make us, but like doing it in this way where this does feel like a documentary of sorts.
Like I said, everything about it feels that you were watching something that was filmed in the 1400s.
Obviously 100%.
You know that, obviously, that it isn't. But when you're watching it, you are swept away into that more than any movie I've seen. Mm-hmm. This truly feels like you are seeing a window into the past.
Yeah. And so I mostly the second part is the consideration of like, what if it was real? Let's look at the witch's Sabbath. So the witch's Sabbath, when the witches come together and rub the witch's ointments on their backs and then fly away on their broomsticks.
Unbelievable.
Out to
looking.
The witch's circle where all the demons come out to dance and they have to kiss the devil's ass instead of kissing his face.
That's
because
right.
That's the sacrilege that they're performing.
Osculum and fame, the witch's kiss, the kissing the ass of the devil.
It's always
the obscene kiss.
And so turning tradition upside down on its head. And this is where we get the amazing effects of the women on the broomsticks, because it is that
it looks so great.
1920s overlay film technology, like the spectrum look where it's like kind of transparent, but they're flying across. And it looks amazing.
It's truly magical.
Like, it really looks, I would put these effects above current CGI any day.
Well, for sure.
I mean,
but
true, they're executed very, very well.
Yeah.
And then down to all the costumes that were made and the different facets of the demons with their, you know,
the demons. I mean, we haven't even
their
talked.
Their horns and their faces.
The demons
and their hooves
look
and
just terrific. And the devil, who's throughout the movie, is played by Christensen himself and looks stunning.
It is right up there. I can't think of a better devil
it's
that I've ever
seen.
It's
what the devil looks like.
And he's got like freckled skin and the long tongue. And it's not overdone. He's just the perfect devil.
Absolutely.
Like, and then the devil is always kind of over in the corner churning his butter.
Yeah, just
which
like
is,
jerking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And flying through the sky, churning the butter and over, you know, kind of being manipulative and leering and churning and churning and leering.
Yeah.
So it's just so remarkable. I was really, really blown away by this scene. And I love that that just the supposition of like, okay, this is the witch's Sabbath. This is what they're doing. And then we move into the trials of the witches. Oh, the Inquisition. And I did have to look something up in this part because they, at some point during the like more, you know, documentary style narrative, the educational, they pointed to an eight-pointed star that people would put on their homes as protection against witches. And I wasn't familiar with that. So I wanted to look it up. So I did real quick. It's an octagram, an eight-pointed star. And there are eight gods in Egypt. So it's fully balanced for females, for males, the god. So it's supposed to be the number of wholeness and balance. The eight-pointed star is also a sign of Ishtar, which is also Venus love. In other like Eastern European cultures, it's a ward off of against evil, and it's supposed to be balance and harmony because you take two crosses, and it even gets incorporated in the Christian church because it's two crosses, the vertical and then the cross that's askew, and they're linked together, which would be part of the compass rose, right? Like all the directions and the wind, but then you get the Rosicrucianism and that rose, the rose windows that are in the medieval churches. And they called it the Mother Star and the sign of the Virgin Mary. So there you have it. But also like the Virgin Mary has also had her history linked to Ishtar in the past as well, because everything, again, if you want to get people to adopt your ways, you can't upend everything that's part of their culture and history.
You start taking bits and pieces from these things.
That's why we have bunnies and eggs at Easter.
Correct.
Because
trees at Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. I love the idea of the witch's ointment.
Yes.
I know what's in the ointment. I want some of this
and
ointment.
And that's the ointment that's rubbed onto the witches in order to help them fly. Yeah, exactly. I was thinking maybe that. But it has this greasy look, especially when you see it being applied later on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the way it shines darkly through the black
almost
and white
like
camera.
Black oil.
Yeah, there. So I used to love, like, remember the old Betty Boop cartoon, the poor Cinderella, like, before it was colorized, the black and white, and she's, you know, singing, and she's sweeping up her house and puts on that black shawl. Do you remember that cartoon?
I have a vision of it,
It's vivid in my mind, because there was this kind of soft, powdery black that some of the, like, early film and black and white have, and this has that full spectrum of black and white.
Yes.
Like the black gets so dark. And I always found the colors to be like sinister and chilling as a child. I don't know what it was like looking at that, like the somehow just the deepness of it. I found it just mesmerizing. And I think that those colors, like having the pale skin and then you rub the witch's butter and it shines like this dark, deep black, and it kind of the body recedes into like a darkness that where you it's obscured, you know, like it's being enveloped in darkness.
It really has that. The witch's ointment mm-hmm. has that effect,
and just those scenes of the witches often in corners doing their, you know, foul deeds or what have you. It's really remarkable, and I just can't get enough of it. But next we're gonna move on to the persecution of the witches, right?
Persecution mania.
We have the printer who has taken into a sleep they can't wake him up from. And, you know, his wife is told that somebody must have cast a spell on him, and she'll probably encounter her soon. And then the other main point that is made in this film is that particularly vulnerable would be the old displaced women. The beggars in the streets, old women that were ugly, that had a scar, that were maimed, anything about them were often thought to be in league with the devil. And so a beggar woman comes in to have a meal, and she's eating with her hands
and eating,
slurping in an,
yeah, getting
in
it
an
all
unseemly
over.
Way,
yeah.
You know, untidy, slurping it into her mouth. And so the wife of the printer thinks, surely this is surely this is the source of my husband's illness. So she has to go make an accusation to the friars down at the whatever area they've set up to do their dirty deeds of witch hunting. And so they say, I hope you understand, this may come back at you as well. And she says, yes, I understand. And nothing more ominous was said like that. Well, I guess lots of ominous things were said, but this is just one of the many ominous things that are spoken.
It certainly does, because when they do torture the old beggar woman, she does eventually confess. And then this part is another stunning section of the movie where her confessions are being reenacted, and she's bringing everyone in that accused her, everyone, but the way that she's describing it, we see the enactment of her description. And again, now we're having this orgiastic.
Yes. So we start with just a simple beggar woman, and we see all the members of the family of the printer and their baby and their home and the women who all kind of go together in the other room to conspire to get her locked up as a witch, and, you know, all of them accusing her and thinking the worst of the old beggar woman. And then she's carted off in that horrible truck where they put the accused in, like a cart you would use for an animal. And she's taken, and she swears that she's never been a witch or practiced anything until they start to torture her. So then we also get a glimpse into the torture chamber where the witch confessions were made, and they lock the old woman's feet up, and then they commence to, I assume they had the tong, so breaking all of her toes, smashing her ankles, torturing and burning her until she's ready to confess. They put the screws on her. They put the screws on her ankles. That was the final thing. And they said, every confession that you give us, he will loosen the screw a bit more.
So she just goes wild with it, and we get to see her description, and it just goes to so many great, dark, and incredibly visually stunning places.
Yeah, so she certainly, like, if I'm sure we are all thinking, if we were put in that position, that would be a great time to find the people that accused you and make them pay, right? Like, if they say you are a witch, you're gonna say, yeah, well, they turned on me because we were in a coven together and we were flying about in the night, and I did have demons of the devil, and I did birth 8 of them, but she was giving the kissing the asses of demons and riding about on their broomsticks, and I saw her smearing a witch's ointment on another woman's back. And so, like, that's the perfect time, right? And your last moment, because you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. Like, if you, you know, you are floated in the river, right?
Yeah,
if you sink, you're innocent, and they cry for your innocence. Yeah. And then if you float, you're a witch, and they rip you out and burn you. So no matter what you're doing in these situations, you're never going to win.
I'm going to read a little more from the Giffnallen article, talking about the filming conditions and how the actors were treated throughout the filming. The film studio, in a sense, became a temple ground dedicated to the dark gods, where the macabre festival was orchestrated by Christensen in his theater of cruelty. Accounts from the actors describe how many of them were submitted to enduring seemingly endless shootings under torture-like circumstances. One of the most important secrets behind the authenticity of Hexen was how Christensen either convinced, encouraged, or simply arbitrarily forced the cast to go beyond all their limitations for the sake of the art. Once they had surrendered entirely under the spell of the demonical movie director, they were his subjects and Satan's slaves on the silver screen. As it should be, the most convincing results are produced if cameras captured the essence of the actors genuinely experiencing agony, dread, ecstatic bliss, fatigue, hysteria, panic, carnal lust, and mortal terror. I do love the dedication and how far he went to make this film.
It took him a long time. It took, what, 2 years?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was. It said it was made over the course of 2 years. And then even once it was released, it was controversial. There were edits made. There were protests that would get shut down.
Yeah, especially taking the finger off the dead man's hand was taken out, and other like scenes of the devil putting his arm around the nude woman. And yeah, exactly. If all of the hoopla that you would suppose would happen.
Yeah, exactly. And but it shows the evidence remains, and it's remains to be such a powerful movie.
It's really, really stunning. Also going through during the confessions, the woman confessing that they had a meal of toads and unchristened children.
Yeah, and then they show like a baby being put into a cauldron. It looks truly grim.
Yes. And so, you know, that kind of ends that section, and then you go into part five, which would be and they said it was the endless cycle of the witch. It's the each one accusing others and giving them away. You couldn't be old and ugly, but you couldn't be too beautiful either, be bewitching.
It was a no winning situation.
And then that kind of led into the story of the friar who was spellbound. He kept asking to be flagellated because he couldn't get this woman out of his head. And the woman was the one who ran to him crying and touched his arm, and he said it burned, who was truly beautiful. And he couldn't get the vision of her out of his mind. And so, again, proof that you couldn't be too beautiful, because in ancient times or in the past, being spellbound, also being too horny for someone.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, he is whipped, and he is, you know, he, because he is spellbound, that the friars take this seriously and have to take action.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the true devil, that the purpose of that, the idea of the devil, Mike, of not being accountable for your own thoughts and actions, right? It's just it's the cop that people would make to say, like, well, I couldn't have unclean thoughts about that woman. I'm not unclean. It must be her fault. It must be the witch that put the thought on me, you know? And, like, I think that reaches into modern times in terms of the modern reluctance to take accountability for a variety of things.
Well, and then, of course, the blame, the passing the blame on, and thinking that you, if you pass the blame, then you're
going to be spared.
Yeah.
But
exactly.
In truth, everyone loses once this whole entire cycle starts. There isn't an end into who loses. Even the spectators lose because you participated in something that was so grim.
Yeah.
And then you look back at where you started and where you ended up, and it's nowhere near you where you would ever chosen had you thought it through.
And you see stuff like this, and people truly think to themselves, oh, I would never. And then we witness years of people doing that exact
thing.
People
have always, like, right? I mean, when just as the young woman who the friar said had spellbound him, is presented with her child, and they say, what, are you going to let this child die orphan to a witch? Are you going to confess, and then I'll open the door and let you run away? Do you truly do?
And this is the section with that, right, where mm-hmm. he's saying he's going to let her out, but he says, but I need you to show me how you make thunder with water.
Yes.
And she's just, I can't. And then she's crying, and then the one guy says, well, look, she has tears, so obviously she's not a witch. She's like, you idiot. Like, they put spittle on their face to trick us.
They know how to do that to trick us. Like, everything is going to be a trick. There's an explanation. Yeah. Like, if somebody finds an out for someone and they're like, oh, well, this couldn't be true. They're like, oh, you're denying the witch. And you know what that means? You're going to be held to the fire as well. So it truly is that group think that can go so far off course, but also make you wonder so heavily, like, who's steering the ship, you know? It taps into this thing that people want to do, and that is convict others of thought crimes.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And I think that has been true forever, and it will always be true until we have like a machine that can just say out loud what everybody's thinking, and then everybody can know that it's horrible.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? Like, you know, when people want to read minds, I want to do that. Like, there's so many things going on, and they're in direct conflict with each other at so many times to, like, say that one specific thing is happening and that's it is such a wild supposition into the human mind.
Well, and then now in modern times, we literally carry around in our pocket this thing that at all times of the day, every minute of every day, you can look, you can accuse, you can be accused.
Yes, yes, exactly.
You can.
You're judging it. You're judging the old gods.
Yeah, and you're, and this is now the spell that everyone's under, and it's everyone's has willingly succumbed to it.
Yeah,
and even if you think you're not participating in it, or you think you never would, like I said, we have seen evidence of so many people just immediately fell under the spell.
Yeah.
And it's important to fight against that no matter what, no matter what thing has been opened with this, the chasm that's been opened with
the constant readiness of accusation.
Yeah. And just this abyss that is, you know, the internet and the modern world and how everyone is attached to it in some way, shape or form or another. Mm-hmm. You can be minimally attached to it, but you're, no matter what, whether or not it's how you communicate one-on-one with someone, it is just how we communicate now.
Yeah.
You're listening to us.
It's
obviously,
how we pay for things. You're listening. It's how we keep our bank records.
We're completely
connected
to it, no matter what.
Finance our lives.
Even if you're not, you don't, it doesn't even mean you're on social media. Yeah, exactly. Like you said, the way you pay bills, the way you
order food.
Exactly. No matter what,
the way you show your insurance card for your car.
And so it's a matter of how much you can fight against getting drowned by that. And getting drowned by that.
Because it's in everybody. But that's the whole thing is, like, that's what's so scary is you can't know what's going on in somebody else's mind. And you can't actually know what they're thinking. But, like, you know, I moved around a lot as a child, right? And so I never could integrate because I never lived long enough to have like those long childhood friends or the social circles or really even understand like the culture because I would go from somewhere like rural to somewhere suburban to somewhere urban. So all that is to say that I have been accused of being a witch a lot. Like I thought it was just a normal part of existing, but I've talked to friends and that's not really part of their experiences being accused of being a witch, like right. Literally throughout the court until now,
right.
People will think like that I am casting a spell on them or that I am a witch or that I'm up to something. I remember when I was in South Carolina, the kids in the playground encircling me and accusing me of being a witch.
Yeah.
So trying to understand like where that comes from is so strange because like I know that I have always been kind of a loner. Like I have friends, but if you aren't from there and you don't know anybody, you automatically have fewer friends than everybody else. You know what I mean? But it's kind of like, but I think it's because I wasn't in their group and I didn't think like them. So I would come up with different ideas that they weren't expecting. And automatically that would challenge their world, right? Even if it's like a rule in a game, or even if it's like, because I like to read books about ESP, and we would sit and try to like, me and my little weird friend would try to like guess which card was being pulled up
right.
as a game, like guess what card I am, try to read my mind, playing those games, you know? And like doing things that they wouldn't consider doing, and so all of a sudden you have to be like in league with something evil. You know, and so I guess that's kind of like watching this too made me think about it. It's just that will that other people have when they see what they see as a spiritual plague, like is said in Hexen, right? They see they see madness. They see a spiritual plague. They see something that, that might catch on, and they think that that witch is going to lead everybody astray. So they need to quench all of these thought crimes of the witch to keep them from going off course from where they want. And I think it's truly other people trying to course correct someone else's mind. Just like now, it's knocking down the old gods, you know?
Yeah.
And, but even now, thinking about how people will, like, there'll be a BuzzFeed article, like, the most problematic movies of the 90s, and here's why. And so they take things that we all knew, things that we loved, and they're like, this is
why destroy it.
This is why they're wrong
destroying
thinking
the old
now.
Gods. Yeah.
This is why that you can only have things that are new in the present, because, you know, every film in the 20s is sexist and it portrays women who are enslaved and they couldn't even have bank accounts and they were owned by their husband.
So how could you watch
and
that?
And then all these films of the 60s were just like, or 50s were just women who were just mind-washed and they were Stepford wives and all, they were just breeding machines at the will. And so you can go through everything and just pick the mentality that you project onto a culture and say why it's wrong-minded without ever looking at anything that that piece said about humanity in the first place,
or just taking it from the time it was done. And when you get into that,
taking it outside, you're talking about its historical and
context. And when you get into that mindset, it's like, how can you appreciate anything that happened yesterday? Like, it's just like,
we didn't know,
you're just like a literal
things that we didn't know about somebody being a piece of shit a month ago. So now that, you know,
you're a literal every day you wake up and there's no history.
Yeah. There's no nuance. There's no complication.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just, but that's kind of what leads to that mentality of like, then you have to crowdsource what's right, because you may say that you like something, but that's wrong, and you're not supposed to like it.
And then you put it out there, and then you get accused of being the witch. And then the accusation is all that really matters, much like in the Inquisition times, because if you float, you're going to get killed, so that means you're a witch.
Yeah.
And then if you drown, well, it means you weren't a witch. And so you're innocent. So you died an innocent, but you're still dead.
Well, it's like
either way, you're
but it's
dead.
It's like somebody being accused of rape. They're either a rapist or they probably raped them. They just didn't hold up in court.
That's all there is, right?
Like,
there's no.
That's it.
I mean, that's how it is viewed.
Unless there's direct proof, and I'm not saying that, like, somebody's never a rapist, but I'm saying that once that accusation has been made, and it's been made in a public sphere, it's happening.
You're drowning and dying, or you're floating and being burned, but either way, you're dead, and it doesn't matter.
It's going to be tragic either way.
Yeah, so that is absolutely how the history we see in this movie moves into modern times. And even in the modern times depicted in this movie, it's 1921, but it absolutely still
stinks.
Yeah.
But it stinks too, because it's in all of us. You know what I mean? Like the want to accuse somebody, the want to pile on, you know, like when you see something and you're like, that's wrong. And you're like, ha, like it is an urge that I think that, and I'm not going to be like, it's the devil's urge. Like, that's not the devil's urge. It's the human urge, right? Mm-hmm. Because we want order, but at the same time, like, we don't know everything and we aren't capable of understanding, like, we don't have an omnipotence about us. So it's like, we want to bring down our judge's gavel without having enough information. And that's truly what it is.
Yeah, it is. So the modern time is a really cool final section in Hexen, because it goes from the church and the torture chambers and the witches' lairs into psychiatric hospitals or mental hospitals or mental
hysterical
institutions.
Women. And
hysterical women.
And he talks about how unattached elderly women are always vulnerable, and shows women that are in like an institution, right, being fed. And those are beautiful portraits, showing like the lines in their faces and their hair, like, again, like the just a thing, it's a very modern thing to do, would be like looking at the beauty in a naturally aging person, right? Like embracing that and showing them in a lovely light, but highlighting their vulnerability.
Well, and even just the way the old women in this movie are depicted and look, it's just that thing where nobody in the world looks like that anymore. They do look like literal witches in this movie. Like, yes. What you think of when you think of a witch.
Yes, because that concept was made and just showing like somebody with one eye, somebody with no teeth, somebody with a hump in her back. But then putting out that sympathy by saying like, look, these check every box for what you think as a witch, but you know, where do these women fit in? And we can see how people are shrinking back and not wanting to be sympathetic to them, you know, and then how maybe the things that were attributed to the devil are still present, like the compulsions that we have. Like, uses an example of a sleepwalker who wants to light matches in her sleep, but is she hysterical? In times they would have said the devil made her do it, but they know she had trauma from having a house fire. So, you know, what do we choose to call the devil? Because the drives are still there. And I love that the through line was also made in ways that the devil is within us. And how often does it feel like the devil's in us? Like when you meet somebody who's mentally ill that you love, and then it feels like they've been possessed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like
they have a break.
Like we had a really dear friend who stopped taking medication because they were going to get healthy and it didn't work. And he had a complete break with reality and, gave away all his possessions, smashed them, went missing, was just roaming the streets of a city as an unknown person. No possessions, no wallet, no anything. And then when we finally saw him again, it was like he was possessed. Like, that was the first time I ever kind of understood, like, people earnestly thinking that someone would need an exorcism. Because I saw his body, but no parts of his personality were there.
Right.
The eyes were different. Like, everything. It was like somebody was wearing his skin.
Yeah. And it is real. And then, of course, there's, you know, you get into this idea of is the medication, where, you know,
is that his real self?
Where's the cycle?
Who am I to say that you shouldn't be this person and that you should be that other person?
Where's the cause? Where's the effect? And how does the cycle begin?
Yeah, and then the medication works so well, you think you don't need it, then you stop taking it, and that's the only way you find out if you do.
Is that what did that break happen? All these things, right?
It's so wild. But it is, it's so complicated, and just like is portrayed here, there are things that are too complicated for us to understand. You know, we aren't omnipotent. We don't possess infinite foresight. We don't I don't understand how to deal with that situation. Just like if somebody wants out of that and they feel like they're possessed and haunted, what's my moral obligation to stop them or not stop them? You know, is it selfish because I care for them to keep them in a cycle that tortures them on a daily basis? Like, you know, these are all of those things, but maybe, you know, are the things that we see where we're lacking, maybe that's where we're feeling the devil's presence.
It's very possible. And this movie brings up all these thoughts, and it sticks with you. Like I said, we just finished watching it, and we're still working through our thoughts on this movie. And it has this really incredibly powerful ending with putting the woman in the institution in a shower and then melting into this pyre of witches, of hanging witches. It's a stunning movie. It's a movie, like you said, Tara, excited to watch many times over. And it goes to show too how inventive and exciting movies from this time can be, from the 20s, mm-hmm. from the 30s. I'm excited to do more from this era. and talk about mm-hmm. films from this era. Like in last episode, how we watched M. You know, there'd be a decade yeah. after this movie, but we just picked up another movie that we're excited to watch from the 30s. It might even be actually from the late 20s. But we're going to be talking about a lot of stuff from this era throughout this podcast because it's exciting to shine a light on this stuff. And a movie like Hexen, the light and the darkness mm-hmm. all there, and the underground spirit, the sinister underground spirit is there with Benjamin Christensen in the 20s, in the early 1900s. And it's as powerful today as it must have been back then. I can't even imagine what it would have felt like watching this back then
yeah.
when there was truly nothing ever like yeah. this. What could it have been to be in the audience in the 1920s mm-hmm. to see this?
And maybe it's just the witch in me, but you can feel his respect for the people who are looking for that esoteric wisdom.
You can
looking for ancient
truly,
history.
He was and truly
yes.
was in this world yeah. of black magic, of demonology. He was completely surrounded himself with this world. And again, just like he this filming of this movie and the way he treated the actors. You know, there's a movie we're going to talk about at some point in this podcast that I thought about a lot while watching this and while reading this article, and I'm excited to talk about, where it does blur the line of reality and fiction and the way the people on screen are actually being treated.
Yeah.
What you're seeing mm-hmm. is blurring all lines of fiction and reality. And this movie, Hexen, has it
yeah.
all the way back in the early 1900s.
And that hunt, like, there's that theory, right, of people who love to read. When everyone's seeking this, like, ancient history, it is looking for that ancient wisdom for things that we can't explain and the things that we can't know. Like, maybe the Babylonians didn't know about it, but maybe they heard about it from some writings that didn't survive from until our time, and maybe they had. It's like the mysterious maps that have been found that depict Antarctica with no ice, and everybody wonders where they're from and how ancient they are, but they were just copied over and over and over again so many times that nobody knows where the original came from, but it's definitely a map of the coastline of Antarctica without an ice cap. And how did people, and it's from like the year 500, so how did they know about it, right? So it's like looking back to see if they had preserved the things that we don't understand more than we have. You know, like our most ancient of gifts, our origin, where we came from, why we're here. If somehow they managed to hang on to that a little more than we did. And that thought and that energy, I think, is present in this film. Is just like, what is it that these people were in touch with a little more than we are about the world around them, about our history, about our origins, about our magic, about our medicines, about our gods, about our existence? What were they hanging on to that we lost hold of?
Very well said, Tarawa. I think we will end this discussion there. I have to thank Christian Olsen for just the great book gift on. Yeah. You know, we've talked about it a lot and just what a great document it is. I do believe there's been a new version that has been released by Franz de Ward. So I'm pretty sure this original version has been sold out, but I do think you can still pick it up. And there's so much more that in this article, you know, I didn't necessarily want to just read the entire article, and I would rather just encourage everyone to pick the book up so you can read it themselves. But it definitely set us off in the path of watching this movie. And it really, with that article and the movie together, really did enrich the entire experience. So check out Hexen, pick up Gift Nolan, and we'll talk to you next week.